What I'm supposed to do is to pretend I'm in the midst of a scientific laboratory, and I'm supposed to look up and say, oh, hi, you know, you discover me here standing in this dumb smock. That's our TV director's idea of how to start the program before the logo. What I'm really doing is, of course, brewing booze. This is Galliano, and that's cream de menthe, and this is rum. No, really, this is a scientific experiment table, as you can see. And scientists do say that someday, in apparatus something like this, they may discover the precursors to life. That is, that someday we may be able to create life in a laboratory. Now, there are many ideas about where we came from. Primordial soup, polka dotted air bubbles in the sea, cracks in rocks, extreme heat, extreme cold, from outer space, or lovesick amoeba. Last time we took a look at the teeming life inside of one drop of water, at little paramecium and the cilia on their bodies by which they move and how they devour various other little tiny organisms and the like. And we were discussing the origin of life. So in a moment we'll come back, and without all of this stuff, which actually would probably be better served if it were producing booze instead of attempting to create amino acids and methane ammonic soups of some sort in which maybe certain components of cells might gradually be formed. And we'll come back and talk seriously about the origin of life. Well, I got out of the smock and I'm a little more comfortable now, even with a necktie on. I don't feel very good standing around a lot of chemical bulbs filled with unidentifiable liquids of which I know practically nothing. There's some things I do know about the origins of life, though, that I'd like to share with you. One of them is that life did not evolve on this earth, and you can prove it by the laws of science. That's right. You can prove it by the laws of science. The more we learn about science, the more we see the absolute impossibility, not just improbability, that life could ever have spontaneously or gradually come into being from the not living. Now, there's a theory or an idea today that life may have come from another planet or even another solar system. I'll talk about that a little later, but most of the ideas about the origin of life today are based on the primal or the primeval soup concept, the idea that the first life came from a mixture of chemicals formed that are being formed, and you can form artificially in a chemical laboratory experiment, and that were formed early in Earth's history. So let's take a look at some of the most commonly accepted theories today and the facts upon which they claim to be based. One thing we know for sure, the Earth has not existed forever. Volcanic activity shows that the Earth is intensely hot in its interior. If the Earth had existed forever, it should have cooled off long ago. But the molten rock or lava you see here is proof that the Earth is still very hot underground. The gases released by volcanoes provide a clue for an educated guess as to what the Earth's atmosphere might have been like millions or billions of years ago. By creating these primitive conditions in the laboratory, or attempting to, scientists can explore how life might have begun. The atmosphere of today contains abundant oxygen gas, but the primitive atmosphere, they say, may have contained large amounts of hydrogen, methane gas containing carbon, and nitrogen in the form of ammonia. Oxygen was only present in the form of water. When charged with energy, chemical reactions occur in the man-made mixture much as they're theorized to have occurred on the primitive Earth. In 1924, the Russian biochemist Alexandro Oparin speculated that life could have originated from organic compounds in the primitive oceans. This theory was tested by Dr. Stanley Miller in 1953 when he conducted an experiment designed by Harold Urey at the University of Chicago. In a flask, Miller mixed methane, ammonia, water, and hydrogen. This mixture was circulated past an electrical discharge, a source of energy. And when the products of the experiment were analyzed, an exciting discovery was made. They were found to contain four amino acids, structural units of proteins found in all living things. ¶¶ Miller's search for the beginning of life has now been extended to many other scientists. Men like Cyril Ponomparuma are probing the chemical conditions which, according to theory at least, preceded life. And these researchers work with the latest analytical equipment and a large variety of energy sources, a larger variety than those used by or available to Stanley Miller in his early experiments. And indeed, in certain respects, their work is very impressive. They have synthesized many organic structures basic to life. Here, water and gases are introduced into the evacuated apparatus to form an atmospheric mixture. Water vapor is frozen out of the atmosphere in the flask. And this enables the methane and ammonia to be introduced into the mixture in precisely measured volumes. The atmospheric mixture is then ready for exposure to a high energy source. In contrast to the electrical spark used by Miller, the mixture of gases may be exposed to intense ionizing radiation for an hour or so. Although sometimes no visible change can be seen in the final mixture, new molecules have been synthesized. The solution is analyzed to determine whether molecules or biological significance have formed. Through such work, this man and others have increased the evidence in support of the theory that life could have originated from organic compounds in primitive oceans. Amino acids, sugars, purines, and pyrimidines have been synthesized in primitive atmospheres created in laboratories. Since compounds are necessary for life, a lot of people have the idea that maybe the molecules necessary for life could have evolved from organic compounds. For example, Dr. Sidney Fox at the University of Miami succeeded in synthesizing some 9 amino acids by heating ammonia and formaldehyde together, temperatures below 200 degrees centigrade. In such experiments, a source of energy in the form of ultraviolet light, an electric discharge or heat, is needed. But this could correspond to radiation from the sun, they say, or the presence of lightning in some kind of a primitive atmosphere. Fox has also demonstrated that if amino acids are heated under the right conditions, they can join in a random sequence to form what he calls a protonoid. Note, however, that Fox's protonoids are actually blobs of random associations of amino acids. They are far from a true functional protein. Such experiments are nearly always hailed by science writers in newspapers, who tend to get a little carried away with the headlines and then, of course, swallowed by a lot of people rather gullibly as being the creation of life in a test tube. Such headlines have actually appeared when the headlines are utterly untrue and totally misleading. Actually, what has happened is that intelligent men using sophisticated laboratory equipment and techniques have been able to, quote, create, end quote, a few of the basic building blocks of life. But it is not life any more than it would be for you to produce some mangled springs, beat up bits and pieces of unidentifiable metal, which may have formerly come from a watch, and say, I was able to produce a watch in a laboratory. If it doesn't run, it isn't put together in the fashion that would make it run, it isn't actually a watch and can't tell time. And because there are some basic components or constituents of what might compose cellular life. Some people assume this is life, but it is not life. There's a vast difference between the absence of life and life. As I've said before, when somebody comes out and says to you, because a loved one is on the doctor's hospital table in there following an operation, the doctor says as he's taking off his rubber gloves, I almost saved him. It was a near thing, almost saved him. That's not good news. Take the famous experiment which some newspapers called man-made life or the creation of life. In the experiment, DNA was taken from a virus and placed in a vessel with building blocks or nucleotides for more DNA. Special enzymes from E. coli bacteria cells were also added during that experiment. The result was the virus DNA made more molecules of DNA, which, when separated and injected to a living host cell, acted like the original virus. The experiment showed a virus can be artificially carried through one step of its cycle. But such an experiment, remarkable as it may be, doesn't constitute creation of life. Why? Well, simply because, one, the DNA molecule of a pre-existing virus was used, that is, the original DNA template, was not made from scratch. Secondly, The DNA reproduced only because it was supplied with enzymes made in and extracted from a living cell. Third, a virus is not really alive, but rather utilizes a pre-existing cell and the complex mechanisms of that cell to produce more virus molecules. No experiment has ever done more than reproduce or copy a few molecules necessary for life, much less ever even come close to reproducing or producing, rather, life itself. Irony that blind chance and accidental chemical combinations are invoked as the resident forces which created the inconceivably complex molecules and structure absolutely essential for the functioning of the most primitive life. Yet, highly intelligent and knowledgeable scientists cannot come close to creating the simplest cell. As I've said so many times, science cannot create one segment of the body of an earthworm, but humankind has managed to create in our own image, or in the image of animals like as not, gods by the millions. No, life has not been created in a laboratory, nor can it be, nor, I will say, will it ever be. If you want to write for something about the probabilities of whether or not that can ever happen, or whether evolution could ever be true, then write for this brochure on probability, chance, randomness, haphazardness, and what probability really says about evolution. And this brochure about the origin of life. Where did life really come from? Outer space? From amino acid soups of methane and ammonia? Where did it come from? You ought to look up what the latest, I'm talking about scientific technology, and I'm talking about college-level textbooks of all the life sciences, what the latest theories really are, and then what the Bible says, and whether or not true science and the Bible are in contradiction, or whether or not they in fact harmonize perfectly. Because I believe, and I believe I can prove, and have been proving continually year in and year out, not only in college classrooms, but on this program, on television as well as radio for many, many years, that there is no contradiction whatsoever between provable science, true science, and the Bible, where you get into speculative science and the ideas of the perhapses and the maybes and the possibles about where life might have come from, then of course there is contradiction. Well, the cell is like a tiny chemical factory with three main parts. So let's get right down into the cell and try to find out a little bit about whether or not this life could have come in the way and the fashion in which they say about this deal of trying to create certain constituents that might make up a part of a cell that are not really cellular life at all. The three main parts of a cell are the nucleus, the cytoplasm, and a membrane. The nucleus, surrounded by a special nuclear membrane, consists of very complicated substances, DNA and RNA, respectively. DNA is an exceedingly complex grouping of molecules which determine heredity and protein building. RNA often acts as a messenger molecule which is sent out to the rest of the cell to determine what proteins are to be manufactured. This tiny nucleus governs the daily activities of the cell, governs cellular division, and determines what kind of cell it will be. Cytoplasm occupies all the rest of the cell except for the nucleus. It's mostly water with tiny structures called organelles, which do many fantastic jobs. Examples are mitochondria, produce all of the energy, the so-called powerhouse of the cell. Lysosomes break down dying cells. Ribosomes are the manufacturing units making protein for growth and repair. Golgi bodies manufacture hormones and enzymes which are used to regulate an animal's or plant's different parts. How they know how to do each job and how they know when to change and do a different job is a mystery to scientists. And then there are the cilia, whip-like appendages presently, singly, or in small numbers at one end of the cell, enabling the cell to move freely and quickly. Vacuoles, often involved in engulfing food for the cell or endorsing foreign bodies. Endoplasmic reticulum, involved with manufacturing processes in the cell and in the transport of materials about the cell. Pinocytic vesicles, structures which can take in quantities of liquid into the cell. And centrioles, short rod-like structures involved in the process of cell division. Even the cell's covering or membrane is complex. It's made of two fatty layers between two protein layers. Somehow this membrane can decide which substances enter and leave the cell. The twists and turns of this membrane are extremely complex, as seen through a microscope, yet it must have an even finer structure. which we can't perceive, to enable it to do its task. Wherever you look at a cell, whether inside the cell, the way it operates, or whatever, you're seeing something fantastically complex. Well, let's talk about probability for a minute. What is that chance probability of life having occurred by accident, by the chance strike of electricity in that amino acidic soup of methane and ammonia of so long ago in primordial or primeval days? Probability is that branch of mathematics that deals with chance, or to be a bit more technical, uncertain phenomena. The probability of a given event is a number between 0 and 1, which measures how likely it is that an event might occur. If an event is impossible, its probability would be rated as 0. If an event is an absolute certainty, its probability is 1. A probability of 1/2 means that it's just as likely that the event will happen as it is the event will not happen. Sometimes this situation is described as a 50-50 chance or even money. The closer a probability is to 1, the likelier the event is. On the other hand, the closer the probability is to 0, the less likely the event is. Probability has a great deal to do with evolution, since the theory of evolution claims that life, all life, in all of its complexity, came into existence by chance or by probability. But how likely is it that amino acids could randomly produce a simple protein? Let's suppose we had a soup full of amino acids. We want these acids to link up at random to form a relatively simple protein or polypeptide consisting of 100 amino acids. How many different combinations are there? Well, there are 20 different types of amino acids normally used in proteins. If we wanted a chain of 2 acids, there would be 20 possibilities for the first acid and 20 for the second, or a total of 20 times 20 equaling 400 different combinations. Put it another way, the odds for a specific chain like the one you see here is 1 out of 400. Similarly, if you wanted a chain of 3 acids, there would be 20 times 20 times 20 equaling 8,000 different combinations. The odds for this specific amino acid chain would thus be 1 out of 8,000. Now, for a chain of 4 amino acids, we would have 20 times 20 times 20 times 20, or 20 to the 4th power. That comes out to 160,000 possible combinations. And so the odds for this specific chain would be 1 out of 160,000. For a protein consisting of a chain of 100 acids, we have 20 to the 100th power different combinations, but 20 to the 100th power is approximately equal to 10 to the 130th power. Now, 10 to the 130th power is 1 followed by 130 zeros. To put it another way, it means the odds for a specific 100 amino acid chain is 1 out of 10 to the 130th power. Now, some people are going to say, sure, those are tremendous odds against it happening, but the universe is an incredibly large place, and there may be billions upon billions of planets like the Earth. Besides, given enough time, anything can happen, isn't that right? Well, let's see. Could this simple protein of 100 amino acids be formed by chance during the whole history of the universe? Say there are 10 to the 25th power stars in the universe. Actually, that's 1,000 times more than the present estimates, believe it or not, but let's be generous. And instead of allowing just one planet like the Earth for each star, let's say there are 10 planets like the Earth around every star. I know that sounds a little bit ridiculous, but let's bend over backwards to give evolution a really sporting chance. That would make 10 to the 26th power planets in the universe. Now, let's have oceans on each planet filled with nothing but amino acids, a real amino acidic soup. That would mean each planet would have about 10 to the 46th power molecules of amino acids. Since we have 10 to the 26th power planets, and we have 10 to the 26th power times 10 to the 46th power equaling 10 to the 72nd power amino acids on all the planets in all the universe. Now, I know this is wild, but in order to give evolution a sporting chance, we'll let all of these acids link up into chains 100 acids long every second. That would give us 10 to the 70th power chains every second, an unbelievably large number. Now, a year has less than 10 to the 8th power seconds. That's right. But we'll round it off and say we have 10 to the 70th power chains per second times 10 to the 88th power seconds per year for a total of 10 to the 78th power chains per year. The age of the universe is about 10 billion years, or 10 to the 10th power. Therefore, we would have 10 to the 78th power times 10 to the 10th power equaling 10 to the 88th power chains formed. So what we're saying is that only 10 to the 88th power chains of amino acids can be formed on all the planets around all the stars for the entire existence of the universe. But remember, there are about 10 to the 130th power different possible combinations for a 100 amino acid chain. Therefore, the odds that a specific 100 amino acid chain will be formed by chance are not 1 out of 400 for a 2 amino acid chain, not 1 out of 8,000 for a 3 amino acid chain, not 1 out of 160,000 for a 4 amino acid chain, but for a 100 amino acid chain, the odds are less than 1 out of 10 to the 42nd power. Now, 10 to the 42nd power is a 1 followed by 42 zeros. In other words, the odds are only 1 out of a million, billion, 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 billion that a specific 100 amino acid chain will be formed on all planets around all the stars for the entire history of the universe. You want to believe in such an improbable event as that? All because scientists don't want to put a name or a personality to the being, to the source out there of whatever gave us our being and our intelligence and our minds and our consciences, our very existence and the very breath of air we breathe. Oh, they just don't want to admit there's any personality. That's the problem. It isn't that science isn't willing, as I'm going to show you in a few moments, to admit there might be something out there. But it is that we don't want that something or somebody, that great somebody in the somewhere, to have a dynamic, living, vital personality and a set of rules, a set of laws. We don't want him sticking his nose in our business down here on this earth and telling us how to live. We want God to keep his nose out of our business. We want God to quit trying to tell us what to do. We don't want God giving us laws and saying you either live by these or you pay the consequences. And so people are willing to say there might be a great somebody in the great somewhere and even sing lovely songs about it as long as they can go along with the lack of a personal God and the lack of a creator God who literally inspired the Bible word for word. Would you be willing to bet your life on the improbability of that event you just saw? In those astronomical figures, and that isn't even a good adjective. There is no adjective that is capable of describing something like 10 to the 42nd power. Would you be willing to send your kid to a school on a bus where you had one chance in a million, billion, 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 billion of his arriving safely? Not very good odds for your kid's trip to school, is it? And remember, we've only considered a very small protein. A protein like hemoglobin having several hundred amino acids would be inconceivably less likely to evolve by randomness or by chance than the one we were talking about. Of course, an evolutionist or maybe even a sincere skeptic can always claim, preposterous as it might seem, that this nevertheless happened. Reasonably based on probability alone, or reasoning based on that, cannot lead to the conclusion that protein could not form at random, they might claim. But it does show the fantastic odds against anything like that ever happening. Even if the evolutionist arguments might be partly right, which they are not, maybe in part some of the statements they use are true, but the conclusions from them are erroneous, and a protein could be formed by chance, would that be life? Is that all there is to life, a blob of protein? Is a dead dog alive because he's got protein in his body? No, protein is just one small piece of an intricately complex puzzle which only the infinite mind of a divine creator being beyond our, perhaps, capability of even understanding is capable of solving. The immutable laws, then, of probability show the inconceivably minute odds that life could ever have evolved by chance. A famed exobiologist, Carl Sagan of Cornell University, in talking about the idea of the panspermia idea, that is the primordial or primeval soup of people going back to this idea of life evolving out of that kind of a soup, that life is eternal and maybe came to Earth from outer space and just lit here someday and found an environment that was hospitable to them. This doctor, Carl Sagan of Cornell University, says no, that's not possible. He says he has demonstrated that unless protected by substantial shielding, even the most radiation-resistant organisms could not survive the intense radiation of outer space. And there is only an infinitesimal probability of a sufficiently massive object being able to escape from one solar system and land on the planet of another. Therefore, the chance of passive interplanetary infection is extremely small. As a result, Nobel Prize-winning scientist Francis Crick and other scientists have come up with the, quote, directed panspermia, end quote. They postulate, listen to this because it's so beautiful, they postulate a guiding hand, quote, you know, their words in quotes, a guiding hand sending life from one solar system to another. The guiding hand is presumed to be a highly intelligent society in another stellar system. Still others have come up with a hypothesis that we on Earth are living in a galactic zoo. The idea is that a super civilization may now have control of the whole galaxy. Just as we have safari parks, zoos, and conservation areas, so they may have set aside our solar system as a wilderness zone. The perfect zookeeper doesn't make himself known to his charges, this a quote from a volume talking about that, and thus we are unaware of their presence. Well, it reminds me of how the Apostle Paul, in talking to a group of people who like to do nothing but sit around and say or hear some new thing, saw on his way up to their area of deliberations called the Areopagus, the top of a hill over in the city of Athens one time, an altar on which was the inscription, "To the Unknown God." And he said, you know, when I saw your devotions and I beheld all your superstitions and I saw this altar, I had to just think, and I'm going to tell you about it, how ignorant can you get? He said, you fools. He said, in him we live and move and have our being. I'm talking to you about the great creator God, and yet you're making all these stone statues to creatures of every kind. I say again that scientists can be very intelligent men when it comes to their experimentations and what they can find practically and by experimentation and observation and measurement and the like. But when they begin to come to grips with the question of how or why and where all this came from and how it got started, they can make some of the wildest guesses of anybody, but they will not, it seems, budge on the idea that that guiding hand might really be a creator, eternal God, and that we are accountable to him. Well, you write for these brochures that I've told you about, or better yet, just call to the toll-free number you'll see right there, and we'll get them in the mail to you immediately. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong, goodbye, friends.
You have seen Garner Ted Armstrong. For literature offered on this program, send your request to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Canadian viewers write Box 44, Vancouver, BC. Or in the continental United States, you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.